Hello there, and welcome to The Forum, where science comes to socialize, the official podcast of the Institute on Science for Global Policy.
Right, so if you've been listening to another podcast purporting to be from the Institute on Science for Global Policy, they're lying. And at least now you've come to the right place.
That was Cleo, everyone. Daniela is also here. And my name is Aubrey. Today, the three of us will be talking you through an episode about all of the evil in the world.
While I can't wait to hear how you're going to tie that into an episode, let's first remind our listeners to give us a shout on social media with their thoughts on today's podcast. Our Twitter handle is @ISGPForum, and for you Facebook users out there, find us at facebook.com/ISGPForum.
We are certainly looking forward to seeing your thoughts on evil doings.
Okay, what are we talking about?
I'm so glad you asked. All right, so you guys know how we talk about new technologies and advances and, I don't know, food safety and vaccines and whatnot, basically all the time?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Well, one of the topics that we've given a lot of attention to over the past 2 years has been synthetic biology. And it just so happens that synthetic biology technologies are advancing rapidly, for better or for worse.
I'd hardly call that evil.
No, let me finish. What I mean by that is that synthetic biology has the potential to change lives. It already does in some cases, in the world of infectious disease, food security, you name it. But it's also one of the most dangerous scientific advancements out there, considering how it could be manipulated for nefarious purposes almost as easily, in a practical sense, as it can be used for good.
Oh.
Yeah, you're getting it now, aren't you?
All right, so today we'll be discussing the policy position paper written by Dr. Amy Smithson of the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. And if you're not familiar with this center, their tagline is combating the spread of weapons of mass destruction with training and analysis. So maybe you can see where this episode is going.
Dr. Smithson's paper was titled Renovating Governance Strategies for Synthetic Biology and Other Dual-Use Technologies, and it was debated at the 2012 ISGP conference 21st Century Borders in Synthetic Biology, Focus on Responsibility and Governance.
Basically, the paper outlines how synthetic biology is a dual-use technology, aka it can be used for good or nefarious purposes, and that this quality makes its governance both critical and difficult. And we will break all that down for you today.
So, recall briefly that synthetic biology describes our ability to manipulate the genomes of different organisms, which means that we can use the technology to make more effective antibiotics, give crops resistance to common pests and diseases, and a whole bunch of other stuff.
All good things.
Right, all good things. And it can be done at the academic or industry levels, as well as within the DIY biology community, which is basically an effort to take the science out of the academic and private labs and bring it to the communities where non-specialists can dabble or learn.
More good things.
Sure, but if you just think about the concept of synthetic biology, it's not hard to imagine how it could be used for bad things too. Take those two examples Daniela just gave. If you really wanted to for some reason, you could use synthetic biology to make an effective antibiotic completely useless, or to make a crop more susceptible to pests or disease. Now, as far as I'm aware, most people wouldn't really want to do that. But there's definitely real-world concern here about a rogue state or group or individual going ahead and modifying once deadly pathogens to make them resistant to every antibiotic we have in our arsenal.
Thereby making them deadly again. There's even the possibility of using synthetic biological principles to design brand new disease agents. And Dr. Smithson gives the example of the possibility of using these technologies maliciously to manipulate human immune, nervous, or endocrine systems.
Plus, scientists have been able to synthetically create diseases like polio and 1918 Spanish flu in the lab. That wasn't for malicious purposes, of course, but it's easy to see how, if different people were doing the work, it could have been.
Yeah, and actually it's getting cheaper to purchase the base pairs, or building blocks, needed to synthesize a disease agent from scratch.
All right, that was an onslaught of really serious dark stuff. So all you listeners get the picture here. Synthetic biology can, in fact, be used for evil. The technology can be, in a way, weaponized. And that's why we need to be concerned about effectively regulating its use, with the added complication that we don't want to stifle research and innovation.
It's definitely a classic problem. We've seen it with GMOs and with geoengineering, and now, of course, synthetic biology as a whole. And Dr. Smithson actually sees a major role for companies and private industry here when it comes to regulation.
That seems weird.
It does, at first, especially when you consider the traditional role of industry in protecting a nation's security.
Do they have a role?
Well, yeah, of course. Industry's role in the security picture is usually just supplying materials or products to a nation's armed forces, or complying with regulations regarding the production, sale, and distribution of certain products, like chemicals that are precursors to agents of war.
Oh, duh, I hadn't thought of that. Well, I guess I just hadn't thought of that as contributing to security or defense, but yeah, that makes sense.
So in general, industry's role is pretty basic. Supply products and comply with regulations, and I guess if something bad happens, have a role in fixing it so it doesn't happen again. Pretty reactive rather than proactive.
And that's exactly Dr. Smithson's point here. A reactive approach on the part of industry might not be good enough anymore, especially when it comes to synthetic biology.
And that's because of the hasty growth of synthetic biology, and the life sciences in general, over the past decade. At the time of this conference, a number of nations were building themselves up to basically be biological powerhouses, including some you probably wouldn't have guessed. Ready? Here we go. Brazil, China, Cuba, Egypt, India, Mexico, Russia, Singapore, South Korea, and Taiwan.
And it's not just a growing number of countries having synthetic biology capacity that should trigger careful regulation. It's equally, perhaps more so, a growing number of people. As Dr. Smithson pointed out, the use of automated equipment in synthetic biology has made it so that people with very little scientific background are capable of performing advanced life science work.
And for reasons such as these, industry is navigating some uncharted waters here, and they've been thrust into a space demanding advanced regulation.
Almost literally uncharted waters, though, because companies expanding operations across borders has been a major catalyst when it comes to delineating new corporate responsibilities, synthetic biology related or otherwise. And speaking of new corporate responsibilities, it bears mentioning that in 2010, the International Standardization Organization issued a statement listing six corporate responsibilities that you should be aware of. 1, consumer issues. 2, fair operating practices. 3, environment. 4, labor practices. 5, human rights. And 6, community involvement / development. This will be relevant later, I promise.
But you'll notice that those tenets are vague and, well, if you're going to apply them to synthetic biology, they're going to have to be extrapolated quite a bit. Fortunately, though, other voluntary actions on the part of companies have dealt with synthetic biology directly, which can be seen as a step in the right direction.
What Danielle is referencing here is a series of safeguards voluntarily established by the companies that make up the International Association of Synthetic Biology and the International Gene Synthesis Consortium. What are these safeguards, you may ask?
This is seriously key.
Broadly, they try to prevent rogue agents from being able to perform nefarious deeds using the synthetic biology tools that they, the company, provide.
More specifically, though, these companies are screening orders for synthetic biology products, ranging from actual genes to synthesis equipment, to make sure that the genes requested cannot be combined to make a product like anthrax, or so that synthesis equipment isn't being shipped off to people with criminal histories or terrorist associations.
And this screening is being done using government-compiled lists of quote-unquote bad guys, such as the United States Specially Designated Nationals and Germany's Handbook of Export Controls lists.
Legit.
Definitely. I think that's the goal. If you're going to prevent problems, start with the best and, hopefully, most complete list out there.
Dr. Smithson mentioned that this sort of screening activity is actually reflective of a public-private partnership established after the September 11, 2001 terror attacks, in which companies providing dual-use technologies report suspicious customer orders to the FBI. The FBI then goes ahead and cross-references the customer with its many databases of terrorists, front companies, black marketeers, and the like.
Yeah, so this is a pretty under-the-radar practice that I really learned about for the first time from Dr. Smithson's paper and debate. But apparently there are hundreds of companies involved, ranging from chemical and internet companies to agricultural facilities. Thousands of notices are sent to the FBI every year, resulting in criminal prosecutions. The end result for all of us is that we're made safer without even realizing it.
And importantly for today's topic of keeping synthetic biology from being used in a harmful manner, this program proves that voluntary data sharing can be helpful.
But synthetic biology is its own ballgame. Will voluntary data sharing be enough to address the threat?
Okay, so that's the key here. There is an international policy addressing the spread of biological germ weapons, and that's called the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention. But it's not super effective at monitoring state-level bioweapons work, not to mention the fact that it can't and doesn't touch non-state actors. So we're talking about the rogue groups or individuals that we worry could misuse synthetic biology technologies.
Not to mention the fact that local law enforcement officials, you know, the people who would actually be on the lookout for a disgruntled employee using DIY biology in his basement to make, you know, some deadly virus, well, they have no training for what to look for in this regard. Dr. Smithson gave the example of Nipah virus. Investigators aren't going to know what to look for here.
I'm not sure I could tell you what that is.
Well, and that's exactly the point. You can't combat something you're unaware of. Nipah virus, by the way, is a fruit bat-borne disease affecting both humans and animals.
In any case, government is definitely not keeping up with regulation of life science technologies, especially when you consider the overall speed of technological development. Part of the challenge here is the fact that policymakers would need to learn a heck of a lot of technical details in order to devise the most appropriate regulatory measures.
And we've said this before on the show, science policy isn't the only thing on the docket of policymakers. They've got a lot to worry about, making establishing this understanding of important scientific issues particularly challenging.
And it doesn't leave them in a great position to devise new regulations. But that doesn't keep them from being the actors tasked with establishing new regulations. It's really a tricky spot to be in.
Plus, it's hard to believe that the international community could agree on big control measures regarding these sorts of technologies. And it's no surprise that these measures should be international to, you know, actually be effective.
But that's not the only challenge. Academic researchers are also going to balk at more strict regulatory measures, since it would make it harder to do their research. This is the stifling innovation argument, of course.
So this is where Dr. Smithson's policy recommendations come into play, because those challenges mostly come into play if the regulation is coming from the top down, which means, of course, from the government. Now, I think you'll start seeing why we've spent so much of our time today discussing voluntary data sharing and regulation. Dr. Smithson really does think that voluntary measures, i.e. not from the government, should provide the foundation of synthetic biology regulation to prevent dark deeds from being done.
The debaters spent a lot of time talking about this. The general consensus was that, yes, a lot of voluntary regulation needs to happen and should be facilitated.
So it would be like Ollivander informing the Ministry of Magic whenever a Death Eater came into his shop to buy a new wand.
Yes, in the spirit of our great love of Harry Potter on this show, that is the idea.
But if you want to extend the analogy, Dr. Smithson's first recommendation would likely be to have all the shopkeepers in Hogsmeade, at least the ones whose shops sell dual-use wizardry things.
Wands, polyjuice potion.
Yeah, have them agree to this sort of voluntary reporting to the ministry.
This is so great. But yeah, so Dr. Smithson thinks a seventh pillar needs to be added to the International Standardization Organization's Pillars of Corporate Responsibility we talked about a little while ago. See, I told you that'd be relevant eventually. Namely, that seventh pillar would involve, quote, industry best practices to prevent the diversion of products for malevolent purposes.
And this is really logical. Think about it. These companies know both the tech and the business trends, so they're probably in the best position to identify where regulation and watchful eyes are needed most critically.
So governments should encourage these life science companies to take part in the governance conversation. There are similar goals here. Neither governments nor the companies themselves want the products used for malicious activity.
Yeah, could you imagine the economic losses a company would face if they supplied a person with the materials needed to commit, like, an act of terror?
Plus, the damage to their public image. No amount of Twitter savvy could save them there.
So companies really should be willing here. And let's not forget about that FBI program we talked about. That directly involves companies, but it could be more broadly applied to synthetic biology and life science companies. and could potentially even be impactful if its jurisdiction was expanded beyond US borders.
Oh, right. I forgot the FBI was an America thing.
Yeah, well, think of the impact that that program, or an analogously modeled international version, could actually have if the US government lobbied major supplier nations to adopt a similar model.
To people who aren't super familiar with international law and regulation, this sort of public-private partnership voluntary data sharing might sound enormously complicated, but it's actually not unprecedented.
That's right. The debaters liken the conversation to nuclear, chemical, and biological warfare, about which two public-private partnerships have been established. These are called the Financial Action Task Force and the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1540 Committee.
With these partnerships in mind, the debaters supported the idea of expanding the global synthetic biology databases already established by the FBI, the International Association for Synthetic Biology, and the International Gene Synthesis Consortium.
So basically, expand the use of, maybe even work to merge, the examples we've given today. The FBI program, which heavily involves government blacklists but doesn't expressly deal with synthetic biology, plus the voluntary database cross-checking being performed by synthetic biology companies.
Best of both worlds.
So it's worth mentioning that at the time of this debate, our conference participants noted that some private sector and even watchdog groups had been working at small scales trying to figure out more of the self-regulation scheme.
But it was argued that those conversations needed to be happening on a much more global and inclusive scale.
I feel like we've said that 5 times now.
Well, if it really got off the ground, I could see this voluntary regulation being really useful for helping to monitor DIY biologists and even other garage scientists.
I could see that too, since those people would need to order their materials from somewhere, presumably some company, but we've got to admit that the debaters weren't able to agree on one solution for the regulation of load-acting synthetic biologists.
Yeah, a lot of their concern regarding the DIY biology community involved the availability of technical equipment, especially secondhand equipment, like when a university donates or sells old equipment that's still usable. That sort of transaction, however innocent on the part of the seller, can be hard to track and control. Plus, I doubt the university would be thinking, I wonder if this person wants to buy our DNA synthesis equipment to make the plague in his garage.
Right, that's just not their immediate line of thinking.
And that's the kind of sale that's hard to monitor. The debaters did note that the UN Resolution 1540 Committee does this sort of work to appropriately match old equipment for use in less wealthy countries, and that maybe this sort of activity could be expanded or offered through another organization.
Okay, so here's the question. We want to monitor people doing science in their basements, but what about people doing science in the actual life science companies? If I've learned anything from Hollywood, some of the biggest problems can be caused by an inside man. What if someone working at a life sciences company intends to use that access and position to do harm?
That's actually a hugely important question. Debaters suggested that synthetic biologists in general be screened and background checked, but this was met with some controversy.
How? That seems totally fair.
Well, applying these sorts of restrictions to academics could easily restrict innovation, especially considering that regulations in academia are sometimes already restrictive. Though debaters did suggest that academics take more authority of and participation in synthetic biology governance.
Hold that thought, because I want to talk about that a little more. But to finish the background check thought, there was no conclusion regarding whether this would be effective or not at the private industry level. Although, I suppose that sort of screening, decided upon by individual companies, could become part of some self-regulation system that the debaters wholeheartedly agreed needed to happen.
Which, all in all, is seen favorably on the part of companies, especially when compared to overarching government regulation.
Okay, so back to the academics defining governance thing. I'm sorry, but what?
Sounds weird to you?
Yes.
I think this is best explained by analogy.
Probably.
Okay, so here's the comparison. When it comes to research of nuclear technologies, for instance, researchers have had a lot on their plate. They've been asked to participate in governance questions, be held accountable both professionally and, when necessary, criminally for their actions, and educate the public. We haven't asked the same of any synthetic biologists.
But maybe we should.
Maybe we should.
it definitely helped to address the whole policymakers aren't experts in the area problem.
That's an interesting thought.
I think we can end on interesting.
Yeah, this is a pretty complex topic, but really, really important, even though many of us have probably never even considered it before.
So to recap, synthetic biology is a tool of the life sciences, which has the power to do a lot of good and a lot of bad. The quintessential example is the ability to use synthetic biology to synthesize new or old diseases.
For this reason, regulation of synthetic biology is a must, but regulation can't stifle innovation and has been challenging to accomplish because of the pace of advancement in the field.
So, companies might have a large role to play here in voluntarily regulating their sales, and they can work within existing, or possibly new, public-private partnerships to cross-reference their customers' orders with quote-unquote bad guy lists.
The more global, the better.
So, what did you think of the propositions made within the debate? How likely are companies to band together in a mode of self-policing? How does this sort of behavior get established internationally?
And that big left up in the air question. How does the DIY biology community fit into this picture?
Let us know on Twitter at ISGPForum or on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGPForum.
And come back in 2 weeks for our next episode.
Yes, that. Do that. On behalf of everyone at the Institute on Science for Global Policy, thank you for socializing with science today, and we hope you've learned a bit about international regulation of dual-use technologies. We'll catch you next time when a whole new topic is up for discussion right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.